Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Obama reassures Baltic states of NATO resolve to defend them, and Putin floats action plan for peace in eastern Ukraine. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama condemned Russia's intervention in Ukraine Wednesday as a brazen assault on the country's integrity and assured three former Soviet satellite states that NATO would defend them against any aggression by Moscow. Mr. Obama said that Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia had lost their independence before to Moscow, but that with NATO, you will never lose it again. The American leader spoke to a crowd of 2,000 people in a concert hall in the Estonian capital, Tallinn. Mr. Obama declared that NATO would be resolute in defending the three Baltic states on Russia's western border.
First, we will defend our NATO allies, and that means every ally. In this alliance, there are no old members or new members, no junior partners or senior partners. They're just allies, pure and simple.
NATO agreed in 1997 to not position its troops on Russia's border, but Mr. Obama said that declaration will be open to discussion at Thursday's NATO summit in Wales because circumstances clearly have changed with Moscow's involvement in Ukraine. Mr. Obama announced plans to send more aircraft to the Baltics as he seeks to reassure nations on edge about Russia's military involvement in Ukraine and possible Russian threats to the Baltic states. Russian President Vladimir Putin has put forward what he called an action plan for peace in eastern Ukraine amid contradictory reports on whether a ceasefire had been reached between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatist rebels. This is VOA News. Speaking in the Mongolian capital of Ulaanbaatar, Mr. Putin said both the Ukrainian government forces and the rebels should halt active offensive operations in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions of eastern Ukraine. The Russian leader also urged full-fledged and objective international control over ceasefire compliance, a ban on the use of military aviation against civilian areas, an unconditional prisoner exchange, the opening of humanitarian corridors for the movement of refugees and relief supplies, and the possibility of sending in teams to repair damaged infrastructure. U.S. President Barack Obama says the beheading of an American journalist by Islamic State militants was a horrific act of violence. Speaking to reporters Wednesday in Estonia, Mr. Obama said those who killed Stephen Sotloff have failed in whatever they are trying to achieve because the United States and the world are repulsed by their barbarism and will not be intimidated. Statement early Wednesday from the National Security Council said U.S. intelligence agencies analyzed a video showing Sotloff's killing and judged it to be real. President Barack Obama says U.S. airstrikes have blunted the momentum of Islamic State militants in Iraq and that now a regional strategy is needed to degrade and destroy the group. Mr. Obama told reporters Wednesday in Estonia that the U.S. will continue leading a broader effort against what he called the barbaric and ultimately empty vision that the Islamic State represents. He cautioned that the effort will take time, but expressed confidence that it can be successful. A British nurse infected with Ebola has been released from the hospital after recovering from the virus. The Royal Free London Hospital said Wednesday that William Pooley's 10 days of treatment included the experimental drug ZMapp. He was taken to the hospital last month after contracting Ebola while working in Sierra Leone. Doctors Without Borders said Tuesday the world is losing the battle against Ebola and warned the deadly virus will not be stopped unless wealthy nations dispatch specialized biological disaster response teams to West Africa. Pakistan's military says it has killed more than 900 militants and lost 82 soldiers since June, when it launched a major counterinsurgency offensive in a volatile tribal region near the Afghan border. A military statement said Wednesday it has eliminated terrorist bases from major towns of North Waziristan, including its administrative center, Miranshah. Army officials say they have also destroyed some 27 bomb-making factories, seized weapons, and communication equipment. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
This Ebola epidemic is the largest and most severe and most complex we've ever seen in the nearly 40-year history of this disease.
That's WHO Director General Margaret Chan briefing reporters today on the Ebola outbreak. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Somalia's government has welcomed the drone strike that targeted leaders of the militant group Al-Shabaab.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. President Barack Obama condemned Russia's intervention in Ukraine today as a brazen assault on the country's integrity and assured the three former Soviet satellite states that NATO would defend them against any aggression by Moscow. Mr. Obama said that Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia had lost their independence before to Moscow, but that with NATO, you will never lose it again, he says. The American leader spoke to a crowd of 2,000 people in a concert hall in the Estonian capital, Tallinn, after meeting with the leaders of three Baltic states who joined the U.S.-European military alliance in 2004. Mr. Obama also spoke about the beheading of an American journalist by militants of the Islamic State, or ISIS. He called the action a horrific act of violence. A video released on the internet by the militants blames President Obama and the U.S. bombing of Iraq for the execution. Speaking to reporters today, Mr. Obama said those who killed Stephen Sotloff have failed in whatever they are trying to achieve because the United States and the world are repulsed by their barbarism and will not be intimidated.
I want to say that today the prayers of the American people are with the family of a devoted and courageous journalist, Stephen Sotloff. Overnight, our government determined that tragically, Stephen was taken from us in a horrific act of violence. We cannot even begin to imagine the agony that everyone who loves Stephen is feeling right now, especially his mother, his father, and his younger sister. So today our country grieves with them. Like Jim Foley before him, Steve's life stood in sharp contrast to those who murdered him so brutally. They make the absurd claim that they kill in the name of religion, but it was Stephen, his friends say, who deeply loved the Islamic world. His killers try to claim that they defend the oppressed, but it was Stephen who traveled across the Middle East, risking his life to tell the story of Muslim men and women demanding justice and dignity. Whatever these murderers think they'll achieve by killing innocent Americans like Stephen, they have already failed. They failed because, like people around the world, Americans are repulsed by their barbarism. We will not be intimidated. Their horrific acts only unite us as a country and stiffen our resolve to take the fight against these terrorists. And those who make the mistake of harming Americans will learn that we will not forget, and that our reach is long, and that justice will be served.
After leaving Estonia, Mr. Obama joins the leaders of the 27 other NATO nations for a summit aimed at sharpening Western support for Ukraine as Kiev battles a months-long rebellion by pro-Russian separatists near the Russian border. The summit is set to focus on proposals to establish a rapid reaction NATO force capable of deploying quickly to Eastern Europe. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko is due to attend.
Top officials of the World Health Organization are in Washington today, briefing U.S. officials on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and the DRC. They held a teleconference to give an update on the outbreak. Dr. Margaret Chan is WHO Director General. She spoke first about the outbreak in West Africa.
This Ebola epidemic is the largest and most severe and most complex we've ever seen in the nearly 40-year history of this disease. No one, even outbreak responders, with experience dating back to 1976 to 1995, people that were directly involved with those outbreaks, none of them have ever seen anything like it.
Dr. Chan says the death toll from Ebola continues to rise.
Now, as of this week, we are reporting 3,500 cases confirmed and probable cases in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. More than 1,900 deaths, and the outbreaks are raising ahead of the control efforts in these countries.
She says the outbreak reported in Lagos, Nigeria, is much smaller than in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. All the cases are linked to one airline passenger from Liberia. Health officials are trying to determine with whom the man may have been in contact. As for Senegal, the first Ebola case was reported on August 29th. The case involves a young man who arrived from Guinea. So far, this is the only Ebola case in Senegal reported.
Democratic Republic of Congo, this outbreak is smaller. And at this point in time, we have epidemiological evidence as well as viruses sequencing to demonstrate clearly that this is an independent outbreak. It is not a spread from West Africa to Central Africa.
The WHO Director General called on the world not to stigmatize Africa because of the Ebola outbreak. She says stigmatization has already hindered the global response by restricting transport of essential health worker supplies and food. Dr. Chan calls Ebola a global threat that needs a large coordinated international response. Also briefing the media was Dr. David Nabarro, Senior UN System Coordinator for Ebola disease. He says a 12-part response is needed to end the Ebola outbreak.
They include, firstly, efforts to strengthen communication and messaging and indeed the mobilization of societies about the outbreak, and in particular to make sure that the information that people have is the correct information, true understanding of how you do and do not get infected. Secondly, care for people who have the infection. Impossible to control this outbreak if people who are infected cannot access good care, and also if those who provide the care are not able to do it in a way that controls the extent to which infection is passed on to others. And this does include the handling of those who do not survive, and in particular the safe and dignified disposal of their bodies.
Dr. Nabarro says the plan also includes quickly diagnosing those infected with the Ebola virus and locating those who may have been in contact with them. He warns that health care for the other diseases, such as malaria, in the affected countries is not functioning. That's due to the strain placed upon the system by the outbreak. He says Ebola is affecting food security.
The need to make sure that food and nutrition are not in any way impaired, because if communities can't access food, then they will end up with nutritional challenges, which will compound their difficulties.
Dr. Nabarro also recommends better transportation, more protective gear, and many more healthcare personnel. The World Health Organization will bring together experts tomorrow and Friday in Geneva to discuss experimental Ebola vaccines and therapies.
Also, Yeheyas, a U.S. medical mission in Monrovia, Liberia, reports a third medical staff member is infected with the Ebola virus. Service and Mission, or SIM USA, released a statement that an American obstetrician working at Elwha Hospital has tested positive with the virus. The doctor, who worked in a department separate from the Ebola isolation ward, has not been identified. Dr. Kenneth Brantley was the first of three SIMS staff to be infected. He was reported to have fully recovered after receiving an experimental ZMAP therapy at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. A local patient who escaped from its isolation unit was forcibly returned after angry crowds surrounded him. Several health workers in the heavy yellow protection protection suits, and a colleague wearing a Doctors Without Borders T-shirt captured the patient and drove him back to the hospital in an ambulance. In London, the Royal Free Hospital announced that a Western health worker infected with the virus has been released from a special isolation unit after being treated with the experimental ZMapp drug. William Pooley is a 29-year-old nurse who was working in Sierra Leone when he contracted the virus.
Research being conducted at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in Israel shows a promise of an antibody therapy for another deadly strain of the virus called the Sudan Ebola virus. The strain killed more than 400 people in previous outbreaks. The findings were reported in the publication called ACS Chemical Biology. In Sudan, the Minister of Health Affairs for the Darfur region recently refuted claims that a man who died in a hospital in El Jenin suffered from Ebola. El Jenin is the capital of West Darfur. Health Minister Firdaus Abdel Rahman Yusuf said the patient was diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. The Sudan News Agency says the minister identified the victim as a resident of Chad.
Well, Yehias, we are now 6 months into the worst Ebola epidemic in history. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known by the acronym MSF, says the world is losing the battle to contain the spread of Ebola. During a speech yesterday in Johannesburg, South Africa, MSF International President Dr. Joanne Liu says leaders are failing to come to grips with this transnational threat. She says MSF has been ringing alarm bells for months, but the response has been too little, too late. The outbreak began 6 months ago, but was only declared a public health emergency of international concern on August 8th. James Kambaki is head of human resources for MSF. From Johannesburg, he spoke with me about why international leaders need to take action now to contain the virus.
I think the situation is catastrophic. It's really bad because we still have high increase of cases, at the same time increase of deaths, and it's still spreading. The support is inadequately dangerous, which makes the outbreak completely out of control. It's almost like saying it's just a drop of the ocean. What Doctors Without Borders is currently doing is still small. We need a lot of help in order to control this outbreak. Families are broken down. The health infrastructure completely collapsed. The ordinary care that regular people should be getting is not there because people fear to go to the hospitals. Our isolation wards are completely overwhelmed. We have to turn away patients who require to be cared in this isolation ward. It is really bad, as our president spoke yesterday about. We are made now to actually build crematoriums instead of more wards that is required.
Also, Dr. Liu, in her address yesterday on the Ebola crisis, she laid out specific instructions for countries to contain the epidemic. She also prioritized these steps. So can you just briefly review some of these procedures?
I think the first thing that needs to be done is we need to set up more isolation wards. We need to scale it up. We need to put it in all hot points where patients come into a contact, because we still have about 23% recovery rate from those isolation wards. So we need more of those. Secondly, I think we need deployment of mobile laboratories to actually aid diagnostics of suspected cases so that we don't isolate those patients who are suspected together with those who are confirmed. And then we need to open up the region, because I think most governments have either canceled their flights. Airplanes have stopped going to those countries. Many countries are closing up their borders. We need to open those things so that it can actually aid deployment of more support to those particular countries. We need to build regional networks of field hospitals that could treat suspected or infected personnel, because we also have personnel who have been infected and they need also care. Those are just a few things, but I think in a nutshell, what the president was saying, that it's now beyond only medical humanitarian organizations to really do the work. We also need governments to come up with more solutions, like, for example, what she talked about yesterday was involvement of the military specifically to support with biohazard techniques, which we know that is available within the military. This could actually aid the enhancement of more people to come actually and support in controlling Ebola.
Earlier, you talked about the overall failure now of health systems in the countries in West Africa affected by Ebola and how this failure has actually caused people to die from preventable ailments such as diarrhea, malaria. Even pregnant women with complications are not getting the health care that they need. Do you have any figures on these patients who are really affected by the failure of health systems due to the Ebola crisis?
We don't actually have these figures anymore because they don't come. They don't go to health facilities. So we actually don't know how many of these people actually die from those diseases that usually could have been prevented or could have been treated easily in a normal hospital setup. So I think what needs to be done is that we need international community actually to do more. It's now 6 months since the outbreak has started, and yet we are not able to control it. We need more hospitals to be brought in, more facilities to be started in those areas so that people could be able again to trust to go to these facilities. Because if it's overcrowded, if it's not enough, if we still have those people that we are going to turn back even from Ebola, what will happen now for ordinary cases? I think what she's saying is that let's work harder for the next 3 months to put up structures that the public can actually trust, people can actually go to actually seek ordinary healthcare assistance.
That was James Kambaki, head of human resources for MSF. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Somalia's government has welcomed the drone strike that targeted leaders of militant group Al-Shabaab. The U.S. military says it targeted Al-Shabaab's number one commander, Ahmed Abdi Godeen, but it's not yet confirmed whether he was killed. Abdulaziz Bilo has more from Mogadishu.
Hours after the U.S. claimed responsibility for an airstrike against the Al-Shabaab leadership, authorities in the capital, Mogadishu, held an urgent cabinet meeting to discuss the latest security operations. After the meeting, the officials said they welcomed the drone strike. Government spokesman Ridwan Haji Abdiweli told reporters that the government supports any operations against the militant group. He said the target of this operation were the key commanders of the Al-Shabaab. Such attacks will continue, he said, because it's only the Somali government that has the authority to govern this nation and not terrorist groups like the Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has neither confirmed nor denied reports that its top leader, Abdi Ahmed Godane, was killed in the attack. If confirmed, his death will be a serious setback for Al-Shabaab. At least six people were reportedly killed in the drone strike, which took place in Sablale, an agricultural town in southern Somalia. The town is 60 kilometers from Barawe, the last remaining Al-Shabaab bastion in southern Somalia and a key port for the group. African Union forces in Somalia recently launched an offensive codenamed Operation Indian Ocean. This operation is aimed at seizing ports from Al-Shabaab and cutting off crucial sources of revenue. General Abdirizak Khalif Ilmi is Deputy Chief of Defense of the Somali National Army. He says that the operation will dislodge Al-Shabaab from many parts of the country and return normalcy to areas they have controlled. Just as the Somali population has taken up arms against Al-Shabaab, he says, we want to work together because we have the right to live like everyone else in the world and for children to live in peace and freedom. Al-Shabaab has lost control of the many cities and towns it once controlled, but still carries out major attacks in Mogadishu. It has attacked the presidential palace twice this year and killed six members of parliament. The U.S. government has designated Godane as a terrorist and 2 years ago offered up to $7 million for information that brings him to justice. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA, Mogadishu.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhi. 24 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top story. Doctors Without Borders says the world is losing the battle to contain the spread of Ebola. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new study says the growing popularity of the Western diet could help worsen climate change. As more people make meat a principal part of their diet, the authors say it will be very difficult to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The global population is forecast to grow to over 9 billion by 2050. And as the population rises, so does the need for more food. The demand for meat is rising especially fast in many of the world's emerging economies. The Western diet has become fashionable there. Many studies have warned that the Western diet, filled with fat, sugar, and salt, is triggering more non-communicable diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and obesity. But the new study, published in Nature Climate Change, considers the health of the planet, not just the body. Co-author Chris Gilligan is professor of mathematical biology at the University of Cambridge. He says much of the study focuses on how greater food production will affect land use.
Well, that's going to be one of the major problems as we go forward. That has knock-on consequences then on conservation, on biodiversity, but also on use of land for other purposes. For urbanization, for example, for energy supply and how we manage water. How do we find enough land to produce the crops for crop growth, the crops that are then used to feed animals and also regions for rearing the animals?
The study says using more land for food production carries a high price. Deforestation, for example, would result in greater carbon emissions.
First of all, we think about where is that new land for agriculture going to come from? And a lot of it is going to come from pristine forests. So as you remove those forests, you're removing trees, which are very important traps for carbon dioxide. And in deforestation, there's an increase in greenhouse gas emissions.
Gilligan says greater food production also will result in more methane being released into the atmosphere.
Increasing livestock production also involves a large amount of greenhouse gas production from the animals themselves.
Methane would also be released through the use of manure as fertilizer. The study says increased deforestation, fertilizer use, and methane from livestock are likely to cause greenhouse gas emissions from food production to increase by nearly 80%. Gilligan says what people choose to eat is a major driver behind greenhouse gas emissions.
For many people, meat does taste exciting. It tastes different. You can do lots of things with it in a culinary way, as one can with vegetables, of course. But nevertheless, there is an attraction there, an attraction in saying, well, yes, I eat a lot more meat than I used to.
The study also says that food production is a main driver of biodiversity loss and pollution. The Cambridge professor says reducing greenhouse gas emissions could involve persuading people to eat differently. But he adds it won't be easy.
There may be economic means by which this is done, for example, through a carbon tax. But that's a punitive measure and may perhaps be necessary. More preferable, however, is the notion of the nudge approach to behavior. So how do you make it attractive for people to change their dietary behavior? That is about publicity, about the health advantages, and hoping that that really induces people to change what they do.
Reducing waste during food production, he says, would go a long way toward lowering pollution.
There is a huge amount of loss of material through waste in developing countries pre-harvest and in developed countries, sadly, post-harvest. Were we able to move to a reduction in, for example, waste, that could have a significant reduction in that amount of greenhouse gas emission.
The UN Environment Program estimates one-third of the food produced for human consumption every year gets lost or wasted. That's about 1.3 billion tons of food that nobody gets to eat. The UNEP says in the U.S. alone, 30% of all food is thrown away. The study goes on to say the Western diet is characterized by an excessive consumption of food. Researchers came up with what they call an average balanced diet.
That was Joe DiCapua reporting. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top story this hour. Doctors Without Borders says the world is losing the battle to contain the spread of Ebola. Coming up, we have music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, the dire circumstances of refugees from Sudan, the DRC, and Somalia. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African football fans have reason to be excited about some upcoming games.
Some big upcoming games, Kim. African football fans are looking forward to a big weekend of qualifying matches for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Morocco. Our African football guru, David Legg, takes a look at the three qualifiers to be played on Friday.
Yes, Sonny, it all begins on Friday. There are three matches and then another 11 on Saturday, followed by another 14 the following Wednesday. But if we look at the Friday matches, the first one, Sonny, the one that kicks it all off, is in Omdurman in Sudan. And it's interesting because it's the first meeting ever between Sudan and South Africa. Now, they could have met way back in 1957 when the Cup of Nations began. There were no qualifying matches then. There was just a final tournament. And South Africa basically said to the then embryonic CAF, we will field an all-white team or an all-black team. We won't field a mixed team. And, of course, CAF rightly said, no way, field a multiracial team or you're out. And South Africa were disqualified. And sad to relate, Sonny, they didn't play in the Cup of Nations until the 1994 qualifiers. So it was a long spell in the wilderness for the South Africans. So they meet for the first time on Friday. The heat is obviously going to be a factor. It's very hot in Omdurman, which is on the other side of the River Nile from the capital, Khartoum. And the South Africans have picked what can only be called an experimental side. They've brought in several young players, players, Sonny, that many of the journalists didn't even recognize the names of when the squad was announced. Emphasis very much on youth. The feeling is that most of the older players have failed Bafana Bafana, and it really now is time for change. And the Football Association have been at great lengths to say that there's no pressure on the new coach, Ephraim Shakes, as he's popularly known, Mashaba, to achieve instant results. But I've heard that one a few times before, Sonny. A couple of defeats and we all know what's going to what's going to happen. But it's a hard one to call because it's an experimental South African team. So I'm going to do something very unusual, Sonny.
Voice of America!
I'm going to sit on that Voice of America fence, which I know you forbid me from doing normally. If the match was in South Africa, I would say South Africa will win, but it's difficult. And the Sudanese have not been doing well of late. So we could certainly classify that as an interesting match to see how it turns out. There's also, Sonny, on Friday, a real cracker. That's in Dakar in Senegal, between Senegal and Egypt. And that's in the group of death because it also includes Tunisia. And then you have the so-called minnows, Botswana, with the greatest of respect to our neighbors down here in the south of the continent. It's Senegal, Egypt, and Tunisia who are expected to fight it out for two places in the finals in Morocco in 2015. Now, Egypt have had a topsy-turvy time of late in the Cup of Nations. They won the title in 2006, retained it in 2008, retained it again in 2010. Fantastic achievement. That was a record third consecutive title. But then they imploded. They didn't qualify for 2012 or 2013, so they have a lot to prove. Their American coach, Bob Bradley, he's moved on after they failed to qualify for the 2014 World Cup. And in his place comes Shawky Gharib. Now, he was the assistant to Bob Bradley. He says he's learnt a lot. It's interesting, Sonny, in fact, almost amusing. He said he was putting the emphasis on youth. And what's the first thing he did? He recalls 41-year-old goalkeeper Essam Al-Hadari. Al-Hadari probably still is among the best goalkeepers in Africa. He's been part and parcel of the Faroes squad for a long time now. Senegalese, Sonny, very impressive when they played Ivory Coast in a World Cup playoff. They've got a French coach, Alain Giresse. He seems to always produce good footballing teams, teams that pass the ball well. And the very good news for all our listeners on the Sunny Side of Sport is that the Supersport channel are going to show this match live. It's at 20:00 hours GMT. I'm going to go for Senegal, Sonny, purely because they've got home advantage. And also, let's hope the Senegalese supporters behave themselves because they've just come back from a one-year ban. They got upset when their team were losing 2-0 to the Ivory Coast in the Cup of Nations qualifier, and all hell broke loose and the match had to be abandoned. So let's hope for a very sporting crowd in Dakar. And then the third fixture on Friday, it's in Casablanca in Morocco, and it's between Guinea and Togo. And this is a really interesting West African derby. Very little to choose between the teams. The highlight here, I think, will be the likely presence of Emmanuel Adebayor. I say likely because 1 minute he's playing in matches, the next minute he's not, the next minute he's changed his mind again. So let's hope he does play. He's been doing well of late at Tottenham Hotspur, and he could be actually the difference between the two sides. So, Sonny, there, the three Friday games, Sudan against South Africa, Togo and Guinea, and the big one, in my opinion, Senegal against Egypt.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. As David Legg mentioned, there are 11 more qualifying matches on Saturday for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Morocco. In one of the games, the Black Stars of Ghana will host the Cranes of Uganda. Our friend in Accra, Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori, has this preview for us.
The Black Stars of Ghana will Saturday host their Uganda counterparts, the Cranes, in an African Cup of Nations qualifier at the Kumasi Babayara Stadium. Coach Kwasi Appiah last week announced his squad for the match and started training at the Accra Sports Stadium without three senior players.
Hi, I'm Makelesian Mefeda, Ghana.
Makelesian, Kevin Prince-Boateng and Suleiman Tari are on suspension. The team will pack up on Thursday and travel to Kumasi for a couple of days training prior to the game. As arranged by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Togo will host Ghana in next Group E game at the Lomé Sports Stadium on Wednesday, September 10. Meanwhile, Ghanaian football enthusiasts are rallying behind their team with a massive support in the doubleheader in Kumasi and Lomé to see the Black Stars qualify for the 30th edition of the Nations Cup to be held from January 17 through February 8 next year. Ghana, for the past 32 years, has not won the African Cup of Nations, and it is the wish of all Ghanaians to make history if the Black Stars lift the trophy in Morocco 2015. For the Sunny Side of Sports, Kwabena Ofori reporting from Accra.
Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. And Mark begins with a world and Olympic champion swimmer from South Africa who won a record 7 medals at the recent Commonwealth Games.
South African Chad Leclos stole the limelight on day two at the FINA Mast Bank Swimming World Cup in Dubai, United Arab Emirates on Tuesday. Leclos clocked 48.59 seconds to win the men's 100-meter butterfly. He went on to snatch another gold medal in the men's 200-meters individual medley in a time of 1 minute and 51.56 seconds. Meanwhile, Tunisian Ahmed Mathlouthi clocked 14 minutes and 55.97 seconds to clinch a bronze medal in the men's 1,500 meters freestyle. In volleyball, Venezuela beat Cameroon by 3-1 at the World Men's Volleyball Championships in Warsaw, Poland on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, Africans continue their quest for their first victory at these championships when Tunisia face Brazil in Katowice and Egypt challenge Russia in Gdansk. Turning to hockey, the World Hockey League One Africa leg, which was due to start today, Wednesday, in Nairobi, Kenya, has been pushed back to Friday, according to the schedule released by the International Hockey Federation on Tuesday. On Friday, Ghana play Tanzania in the women's contest before Egypt play Ghana and Kenya face Tanzania in the men's contest. On Saturday, Kenya play Ghana in the women's tie, then Egypt face Tanzania and Kenya play Ghana in the men's encounter. On Sunday, Tanzania face Kenya in a women's match before the men's fixtures featuring Ghana against Tanzania, then Egypt tackling Kenya. Turning to football, coach Mariano Barreto is confident his Ethiopian national team's three-week tour of Brazil will enhance their chances of qualifying for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. This is the first time the Ethiopian Walia Antelopes toured South America. Ethiopia hosts Algeria in Addis Ababa this coming weekend before traveling to Blantyre to face Malawi next week in their Nations Cup qualifiers. Finally, in golf, East Africa's finest golfers from Burundi, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and hosts Uganda are in Kampala for the start of the Uganda Open Golf Championships today, Wednesday.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The FIBA Basketball World Cup is in its fifth day of competition in Spain. Going into Wednesday's games, there are four unbeaten teams in the tournament: Greece, Slovenia, host Spain, and the defending world and Olympic champion, United States. All four teams have won their first three games. The Greeks are going for their fourth consecutive victory later Wednesday evening when they play Croatia. And Slovenia is playing Angola this evening. The Angolans have one win and two losses. The top African player in the tournament so far has been Senegalese center Gorgui Dieng, who is averaging 21 points and almost 12 rebounds a game. Gorgui and the surprising Senegalese are back on the court Wednesday evening against Argentina in Seville, Spain. Both teams have two wins and one loss in group play. After the FIBA Basketball World Cup, Gorgui Dieng will get ready for his second season with the NBA's Minnesota Timberwolves club. The gold medal game in Spain will be played September 14th in Madrid. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All right. Thanks, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the rapidly spreading cholera outbreak in Ghana. And next, the dire circumstances of refugees from Sudan, the DRC, and Somalia. But first, some music. Here is Big News of South Africa with Rockefeller. South Africa's Big Nose with Rockefeller.
Well, a quickly spreading cholera outbreak in Ghana has killed at least 45 people over the past 2 months, according to the UN Children's Fund. Since June, UNICEF says it has recorded more than 5,000 cases of the disease. Kesem Yukobam, a water and sanitation expert for the agency in Ghana, tells Ricky Shryock the outbreak is becoming very dangerous.
Why cholera is spreading fast? I think first it has to do with attitude of people, because year after year there is education on how people could comport themselves through practicing good personal hygiene. But there again, you realize that we fall short. Anytime there's cholera, surprisingly, people get infected easily. And then it tends to spread out. That is one barrier, that is attitudinal. People do not change their attitude. So this thing keeps on going on.
Is waste disposal a contributing factor to the spread of cholera?
Yes, it is. It is a major factor. If waste are dumped at places that are not right, then people easily get in contact with it. And this is tends to spread cholera very fast. Because last 2 weeks or so, there's a market in Accra where there's a heap of garbage. It looks scary as far as cholera is concerned. So what happened is that the government had to move in fast with the vice president visiting the site. And with that advocacy role played by the vice president, they quickly disposed of all the garbage in that market. I'm talking of a market around a place called Agboblushi Market.
With West Africa on such a high public health alert due to the Ebola outbreak, are there concerns that misinformation will spread and panic will happen and it will make the cholera outbreak worse?
I think as far as the Ebola is concerned, it is a major concern for Ghanaians because it tends to create some sort of fear and panic. Because with the current outbreak of cholera in the country, we're finding it very difficult to bring it under control. So people are just saying that if we are not being able to bring the cholera situation under control, then what is going to happen if Ebola should just come into the country? I mean, we're going to struggle to handle it. So there's this fear and panic in the country.
That was Kasim Yakubam, a water and sanitation officer for the UN Children's Fund in Ghana. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says refugee numbers worldwide dropped in the last 15 years, but those numbers have risen in low-income countries. For example, the Democratic Republic of Congo had 400,000 refugees in 2004. 10 years later, there are 500,000. Mark Yarnell is a senior advocate at Refugees International. He spoke to VOA's Lenok Mudu about the dire circumstances of refugees from Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Somalia.
Well, we're trying to draw attention to the enormous needs of displaced people around the world. In addition to refugees, there's also people who are displaced internally. And while there's new conflicts and new sources of displacement, there's also some people who have been living in camps for up to 20 years or more. And so trying to share the diversity of challenges that are out there and appreciate programs like yours covering this issue.
And in Kenya, there are about 500,000 Somali refugees. You talked about some refugees that stay in camps for a long time. You were in Africa not long ago. There is the case of the DRC, of Central African Republic. What have you seen in terms of some of the dire needs and priorities?
I think something that's quite tragic, especially in the case of South Sudan, is that we met a man who was living in an internal displacement camp named John in Juba. He'd been living as a refugee for 10 years in Uganda. Finally felt that Juba was now safe enough and he could return home to South Sudan. Returned to South Sudan. 2 days later, a conflict broke out there. Now he's now living as an internal displaced person, unable to get to his home state in the north. So the new challenges that are there are compounding the old ones.
So it is true, it's clear that the return of refugees to their home is a challenge in terms of resettling.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, certainly no one wants to live in a refugee camp forever. And especially when we visit the Somalis who are living in Dadaab in northern Kenya, they want to get back to Somalia, but when there's still violence and insecurity, they're unable to do so.
But to what extent do refugees really have the opportunity to resettle? I mean, very few of them are able to do that. Right.
Exactly, and that's why we have, especially in a place like Kenya, so many people who are still living in camps. It's not only that the country from which they've fled needs to be stable, but they also have to have economic opportunities to restart their livelihoods, to be able to begin their life again back where they fled from.
Many, many challenges. You spoke about economic opportunities. There are also their health, security, safety. All of these problems are there. Where do you start in terms of addressing them?
I mean, it's extremely challenging, and that's why, again, I think the attention on the crisis is so important, because you have to tackle it from all different sides. At the very least, we hope that countries that are receiving refugees remain open, so that as people flee, they're able to cross borders into safety. But then once there's the importance of the international community to provide support to those people, because often the host countries don't have the resources to do it themselves.
Now, in Kenya, a framework has been put in place to enable Somalis refugees to return to their countries. But how is this feasible? How is it realistic in the sense that there is still a situation of conflict in the country?
Exactly. There's some parts of Somalia that have become stable, but many parts are still very insecure. Over the past few months, 70,000 new people have been, or new displacement has occurred because of violence there. And so while some people are interested to voluntarily return, We really hope that Kenya will maintain the space for people to keep living in Kenya until Somalia is actually safe.
And very quickly, moving forward, what will be Refugee International's priorities?
We'll actually be going to Kenya next month to visit refugees there and to make sure that that those who are in Kenya are able to live with support and dignity.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday.
And
with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States contributed an additional $6 million to help the government of Pakistan meet the food and nutritional needs of the internally displaced people from the federally administered tribal areas on August 20th. The contribution, provided through the United States Agency for International Development, Office of Food for Peace, is part of the ongoing partnership between the government of Pakistan, U.S. government, and the United Nations World Food Program under the Twinning Program. Twinning is an innovative program that complements the government of Pakistan's contribution of locally grown wheat by paying for milling, fortification, transport, and distribution costs. The fortification process provides additional vitamins and minerals to address the dietary needs of vulnerable populations. This food is being used by WFP to support 1.4 million internally displaced people, including those from the North Waziristan Agency. With this contribution, USAID is now the largest international donor to the program, providing a total of $39 million in support, enough to transform over 60% of the 214,000 metric tons of wheat donated by the government of Pakistan since 2013. The United States has a long-standing history of and commitment to working together with Pakistan to provide humanitarian assistance and support human and social development. In 2014, USAID provided over $60 million in food assistance to Pakistan, in addition to the Twinning Program. Since 2009, the United States has provided over $1.4 billion in humanitarian assistance to Pakistan, making it the largest bilateral provider of humanitarian assistance. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, in helping those most in need with the food assistance they need for a better future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Mushimirimyato. Yeah! Bahungu